everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides. And on the show with us today is the South African hammer, Trevor Prangley, the UFC Bellator Strikeforce veteran, multi-time MMA champion. So glad to have him on the show with us today. We talk about his formative years, including coming to the United States from South Africa, his background in wrestling. He was a very, very successful amateur wrestler. In fact, he was a national champion in South Africa. Talk about his early MMA career, competing in the Four Men Enter, One Man Survives, One Night Strikeforce middleweight tournament, where he got to the finals before losing to George Santiago. We also talk about his two fights in Strikeforce with Anthony Ruiz, and specifically we key in on his bout, the rematch at Strikeforce at the Mansion 2, where Trevor beat Anthony again, but he gave him a rematch there because they had a kind of a, well, it wasn't because of a controversial ending to the first fight, but that definitely was part of it. And we also talk about what Trevor's up to now, his gyms, and then what he's doing in terms of dealing with COVID and that sort of thing. So we jump into a whole lot here. So with that, without further ado, let's get to it. All right, on the line with us, I'm glad to welcome UFC Bellator Strikeforce veteran and multi-time MMA champion Trevor Prangley to the show. Trevor, how you doing, man?
Good, man. How you guys doing?
Good, good. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. You have we're going to jump right in. You have a very interesting background. You're born and raised in South Africa. You got into amateur wrestling at a very young age, progressed well, eventually winning the national title, which is a huge deal. You barely missed making the Olympic team, instead becoming an alternate, and you decided to move to the U.S. to kind of up your training. You did well in wrestling at a local junior college in Idaho, and you got All-American honors twice before an injury really changed things, and you started getting into jiu-jitsu. And I know I just covered about, 23 years of your life in about 30 seconds, but what kind of made you want to make the switch to MMA from amateur wrestling?
Yeah, so when I got done with college wrestling, I had that injury, and I got injured in the finals of the national tournament. And I've always been a competitor and just wanted to switch and compete in something else, and it just seemed natural to go straight to jiu-jitsu. I'd been training jiu-jitsu for about a year before I finished my college wrestling, and got done with the surgery, and just went right into it. It felt natural to me. I enjoyed it, and it was a lot of fun.
There, it's one of the, I know they tried to do Raw, which was like real American wrestling in the mid 2000s, that sort of thing. Obviously, MMA is a natural progression for a lot of amateur wrestlers, but also, you can't really make much money when it comes to amateur wrestling. Once you get past, you just can't really make a lot of money at period, because it's amateur, it's not paid. So does that factor into it at all as well? You're thinking this is going to be a career, you want to use your body as far as, physicality for a career, and MMA was the way to go. Was that part of it as
no,
well?
No, I don't think so per se. I mean, my first fight was in 1998, and there was no money involved. In fact, we, paid our own way to drive down to wherever we went. And, you got lucky if the guy paid for your hotel room. So it was just the competitiveness of it and testing yourself against somebody else. I think I've always wrestled since I was 5 years old, and it's like up here in Idaho, I don't know how the rest of the states are, but when you finish with college, there's not much as far as club wrestling around. So, there's a lot more jiu-jitsu and a lot more availability on that. So that's where I went to.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. Well, you mentioned when you started your career, you turn pro, you end up winning 6 straight, including a submission win over another very strong wrestler in Chael Sonnen, who you'd meet again down the line. You then fought Bob Lusobral, who I actually just interviewed a few days ago as we record this. And you end up deciding, you lose by decision there, end up deciding to drop down to 185. Was that something you'd kind of had in your mind that you wanted to drop a weight class, or was that just kind of forced by the loss to Bobaloo?
It was kind of forced by the loss to Bobaloo. when I wrestled in college, I was always within a couple of pounds. I never was a big weight cutter. So it was, When I fought Bobaloo, I think we fought at 205, and I was just, that's where I was walking around at, so I didn't have to cut any weight, and that was great for me. I didn't really enjoy cutting weight a lot, but...
Who does?
but it was on the advice of my coaches, Javier and Bob Cook, were like, it's better if we cut this weight and get this stuff going,
Well, that made a lot of sense. And, you know, Bobulu, he fought Fedor at heavyweight. I mean, he was a pretty big dude. So it, you know, it made sense there. But I don't know if you've put any thought into this at all, but I looked into it a little bit. I mean, you're the most accomplished South African MMA fighter of all time. You know, Neil Grove had a run in Bellator, but really you're the best guy to come out of South Africa as far as MMA goes. And in early 2005, you were coming off a submission win over Curtis Stout, UFC 48. You got to fight in your native country for the only time in your career. So what did it mean for you to be able to get a fight and a win in your native South Africa?
Well, I actually lost that fight, so it pretty much sucked, to be honest with you.
Oh, well, we got to correct your record then, because it shows that you got a win there. But anyways, go ahead.
You can leave it. No, I went over and I fought at heavyweight, you know, and the reason I went was to see my family. They paid for my whole family to travel over there and gave me some spending money, and it was totally just a deal we did. And I honestly wasn't in the shape to fight, and I was winning that whole fight up until about the last minute, and I was super gassed and pretty much got beat in the last minute. And it was still a good experience. It cost me my next UFC fight. Took me like 2 or 3 more years to get back into the UFC because they cut me after that loss.
Wait, so did they cut you because you lost, or they cut you because you took a fight outside your contract?
Well, there wasn't a contract. It was a one fight contract. And we had called them and said, can we go fight? And they're like, yep, you can go fight. But if you lose, you know what I mean? You're done with us for a while. So that's what happened.
Jeez, that's harsh. Jeez.
Well, that's how it was back then. You know what I mean? People forget the UFC was, when I fought there was only like 4 or 5 shows a year at the most. You know, it was really hard to get into the UFC and hard to stay there. If you lost 2 fights, they cut you pretty much. That was just the way it is. So that's how the organization's a lot different now. The roster was small then. Like I said, the shows were, you know, 4 or 5 a year at most.
Well, things have definitely changed as far
as you know, you didn't have all these fight nights and all that stuff. And I'm happy it is like that now. It gives everybody an opportunity to get in and, you know what I mean? You get better fights and better fighters building themselves in these shows. But it was different back then.
That's why, you know, I love doing this on the podcast, that we're digging into the history of the sport. And, you know, look, we don't have baseball. We don't have football. We don't have basketball as far as MMA goes, as far as the longevity. You know, you talk about baseball, pro baseball, 120 years old. I mean, we're 93. You know, so it's very interesting to see how much it's evolved just in the short history.
Yeah, as I talk to my son's like, well, why didn't you stay in the UFC? I'm like, well, I lost 2 fights and they cut me. Well, why'd they cut? I'm like, well, that's just the way it is. You know, it was really hard to get in because they only did so many shows a year, and it was really hard to keep your spot. You know, you had to perform. The pressure was a lot higher, I think, then than it is now.
Yeah, it's well, and I'll say it's kind of a different kind of pressure, though. I talked with George Santiago, who you faced, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. And we interviewed him about him winning that one night tournament. And one of the things he was saying was that the pressure, in his estimation, is different because you have to have this persona to go along with it, that you've got to, you know, kind of a Colby Covington, you know, Chael Sonnen type. You got to have this persona. And if, you know, if you do and you draw, then you might be able to get away with more losses. But if you don't have that, you better win every single match.
Yep.
Yeah. So
for sure.
All right. Well, after that, you bounced around a little bit. You did end up getting some more fights in the UFC, and you headed to the burgeoning Bodog Fight organization. And while you're under contract with them, you made your Strikeforce debut against Anthony Ruiz at Tank versus Buentello in 2006. And I watched this fight. It was a good one for you. You were definitely winning. And then you catch Ruiz in a very tight armbar. And I remember watching it thinking, well, that's it. I mean, he's done. And he didn't tap, and the ref stopped it anyways. And Ruiz protested. And I felt bad for you. You were in a pretty bad position because you didn't do anything wrong, but the crowd like turned on you, and they're booing you during the post-fight interview in the cage.
Yeah, it was his hometown. So.
Right. You're kind of the heel that tapped out that beat the local hero in controversial fashion. But kind of looking back now, how do you feel about how things went down? I mean, did you feel like you had it, and there was nowhere for him to go? Did you feel like he had a chance of getting out of it?
I felt like it was just a matter of time before he tapped, but I just I don't understand why the ref stopped. It's the weirdest thing. I've never seen a ref stop in an armbar like that. You know, it wasn't like he was writhing in agony or anything, or we didn't hear any pop or anything. It was just a strange stoppage. regardless. And I, you know, I would have been upset too if I was him. So I don't see anything wrong with the reaction that he had and his crowd and followers had. So
yeah, I don't know. The crowd were there kind of jerks for Booing.
Yeah, they can. They can be. They can be. Yeah.
Well, you.
But like, you know what? I did the right thing. Gave him another shot. You know.
Yeah. So. Exactly. And we're gonna. I really want to delve into that fight. We're gonna talk about that. But you would end up getting three straight fights in Bodog fight, and you beat Japanese legend Yuki Kondo for the organization's middleweight title, which is, you know, a big deal. You then returned to Strikeforce for Four Men Enter, One Man Survives, which was a one-night middleweight tournament. Didn't end up being a great night for you. You had a very competitive fight with Falonico Vitale, but that ends pretty unceremoniously due to an inadvertent eye poke on your part, and Vitale couldn't continue, and he was obviously...
I think it was more gassed, you know what I mean? It was, and it was California. You know, if they looked at your eye and you said you couldn't see, they stopped it instantly. I don't think he really wanted it to stop. I think it was more of a ploy to get some breath, because I felt like the tide was turning in the fight. There was a really hard first round. Then the second round, I started to feel like a lot of my fights were, that he was wearing out and I was going to be able to take over for the rest of the fight, you know?
So you think it was a bit of gamesmanship on Vitaly's part, trying to get a little bit more
breathing? Sure. And obviously not thinking that they would stop it, you know, it being California. That's what they do, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you can see then why he was really, really upset if he was just trying to get some, some time to breathe.
He did protest that stoppage quite a bit.
A lot, you know? Yes, he did. Yeah, he was very upset. Yeah, probably even more so than Ruiz, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
But you end up advancing, and then you end up facing Santiago, and it was a fairly quick one, only about 2.5 minutes, and he caught you with the knee to the body, and then some punches. But looking back now, how do you feel about those fights? Did you feel like you were, I mean, it's, you know, I talked with Santiago about preparing for potentially two fights in one night, that you didn't even know who you were going to be matched up against until I think the weigh-ins. So how did you feel about your preparation? You feel good about it? You just got caught. What do you think looking
back? I felt good about it. You know what I mean? And basically I remember, if you remember how the tournament went, I can't remember who the Japanese guy was, but He didn't clear his medicals, so we had to get Sean Salmon in the night before.
Right.
Santiago picked him, and I think there was like a 25-second fight or something. Salmon went to shoot. Santiago threw a knee and knocked him out, so he really didn't even throw a punch in his first fight, not a hell of a first fight. I think my preparation was good. I think I was just really wore out from that first match.
Yeah, you definitely had a much harder first round fight than he did, for sure. 100%. And I'm trying to quickly look up who he replaced, because we talked about it several episodes ago, so I'm not remembering off the top of my head. But it was that first fight with Salmon. I don't know if you did you remember seeing that, because that was one of the, it was a very weird knockout. He didn't really catch him with a knee. It was more of like a flying kind of shin, and it didn't really seem to connect real well. But man, they had to call in the medical people and all that stuff. That was a pretty crazy situation, for sure. But anyways, yeah, it ends up, you know, obviously not going the way that you wanted it to. You were out for about 10 months after that. I wanted to ask real quick, was that an injury thing, or were you just working on your game, or what was the situation?
Yeah, there? No, I had an injury going into that fight. In fact, Bob Cook and myself got into a bit of an argument in the back at the locker room after my fight with Vitaly. And he wanted me to pull out of the next round, you know, and I didn't want to. Obviously, there's a lot of line, some pride. And also, you know, I think there was a $20,000 advancement fee. So it was hard to turn down. And I did feel like I still had a chance. And if you watch my fight with Santiago, I went out and I was just trying to get it done in the first round. And he just did it a little better than me that night and put me down. You know, I was coming forward, I was advancing. I thought if I could just catch him and put him down and not be in there another three rounds, that'd be the way to go. But it didn't work out for me that night.
That's the way it goes sometimes.
What I mean? I don't regret it, to be honest with you. It's just the way it goes, like you said. We were fighters, you know, we paid to fight. And back then when I started fighting, like I said, there was no money. I was just wanting to fight. I didn't want to, it might have been a mistake on my part, but I didn't want to protect my career by not fighting somebody.
Well, it was definitely a challenge, and you know, that's what you got into the sport for. So that makes a lot of sense. Well, like we said, you were out about 10 months after that. You returned as an injury replacement. It was actually supposed to be Bobby Southworth were defending the light heavyweight title against Babalu, a former opponent of yours, and both of them end up getting injured. So you end up doing a rematch with Anthony Ruiz. Was that something that you wanted, either because, you know, you obviously had to be willing to do it, but you wanted to give him another shot because of the controversy of the first fight? You wanted more of a decisive ending. Was that something that you were looking forward to and played into your thinking?
No, not really. You know, it was just a fight that came out, and I think it was a pretty short notice fight, if I remember correctly.
Yep. And yeah, you guys were both injury replacements, so yeah, not a lot of time there.
Yeah, and I'd been out for 10 months, like you said, and you know what I mean? It's you just don't turn a fight down when they come up. You know, I was coming off a loss. I wanted to get my win back and so forth. So I just jumped right on the opportunity, and we went at it.
Well, what was it like fighting at the Playboy Mansion? Joe Diesel Riggs was on the show, and he shared a really funny memory of the first fighting, I believe, the first time at the Playboy Mansion. And he got kind of attacked by like a large bird backstage. He like punched the bird in the neck or something like that. I doubt you had that.
I didn't
have
anything like that. No, it was, you know what I mean? It was just a fight night for me. It was, you know, I was in the back warmed up. I think we fought pretty late on the card. And when we got done, we got dressed and we got ushered out. That was it, you know? So didn't get anything exciting. Walked around a little bit before the fight and checked some stuff out, but nothing too exciting. I didn't get to beat up any birds or anything, which would have been pretty awesome, actually.
Oh yeah, Diesel's stories between that and his very famous fight with Nick Diaz at the hospital after their UFC bout in the mid 2000s. It was a pretty colorful episode for sure. But your strategy was pretty clear in that fight. I mean, just kind of vintage. Prangley, you kept Ruiz on the mat. You really grinded on him, and it worked. I mean, the fight was never really in doubt. You never really let him get off, so to speak. So are you happy with how it turned out?
Not really. You know what I mean? But I did what I had to do. Short notice. I'd been off for 10 months. I was nursing injury. I wasn't in the best of shape coming back into that fight. So I did what I needed to do. If you look at my body in that fight, I look at those pictures and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know what I mean? He definitely don't look like an 85 pounder there. So I was just, you know, but I needed to take it, and I believed I could win it, and we just came up with a formulated game plan where, you know, we could take a win for sure.
Well, you got it. I want to ask real quick, you know, you mentioned 85, and you would go back and forth between 85 and 205. I think your last fight, I believe, was actually at heavyweight, but did you have a preference between the two? I mean, if you're walking around at 205, you know, you had to cut down, did you have a preference between the two of them? I would think it'd be 205 because then you have to cut weight, but did you do better at 85?
You know, it depended on who the opponent was. If it was like an A-lister, I would definitely go 85. I'm not going to go 205 and fight one of the top guys in the country. You know what I mean? It just doesn't work that way. But I was, when it was on a smaller show or a late notice fight with somebody else, I would definitely go to 205. 205, I felt better. But I mean, if you're fighting an A-lister at 205, they're cutting from 230. You know what I mean?
Right.
At that stage of my life, I was walking around between 207 and 210 was about the heaviest I ever got. So,
well, you look so big at 85. Like, you're just such a massive guy. So it, you know, I would think that probably been like your best one, but like you said, it makes sense to, if you're going to do that, you're going to cut all that weight.
Yeah, perfect would have been if they had like a 190 or 195 weight.
195.
Division.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yep. I could, yeah. When I cut weight right up to about 192 pounds was easy. And then those last seven was just miserable. You know,
I don't think there's been any talk of it recently, but I just don't see why there isn't a 195er. I mean, guys like you, I know Robbie Lawler used to do a lot of catch weights bouts around that. I mean, there's different Frank Shamrock. There's different guys that could just do so much at 195. Sure. And I think
it would be awesome. You know,
it's a little late in the progression of the sport at this point.
I think so. I don't think that'll ever change. I doubt we'll add any more weight classes, you know?
Yeah. And we, you know, we do not want this to turn into boxing, you know, super featherweight and junior.
The only way to remedy that is to have same day weigh-ins, you know?
Yeah. Which is, I mean, that has been something that's been talked about to keep people from cutting too much weight and hurting themselves and all that stuff. But it's just kind of one of those things. I just don't know how much it's
going to change. You know what I mean? The bottom line is we're all grown adults and we make a decision to do what we do, and whether it affects your performance or not, it's really not up to anybody else. It's up to the fighter who decides to make that cut, you know?
True.
I've always been a firm believer in that, you know, that you need to be responsible for yourself, and we don't expect the whole sport to change because it doesn't suit where our body type or where we're at, you know?
Right. Well, we're down to our last couple of questions, and I'll let you go. But there was talk of the winner of that fight between you and Ruiz. Because if you remember, Ruiz had actually beaten Southworth by a cut in a non-title fight, and then he'd gotten pretty much very similar to his fight with you, where Southworth just, you know, grinded him, and which Southworth was a teammate of yours, so yeah. I guess that made sense. But you just, you know, he kind of did the same thing. And then, you know, so, but there was talk that you or Ruiz or whoever the winner would be, which ended up being you, would get a title match between Babalu and Southworth. And unfortunately that wouldn't happen, but I mean, that would have been a very interesting fight for you, because Babalu, again, you'd suffer your first career loss to him. So to be able to get that back, would you have ever considered fighting Southworth as a teammate? Was that something you would have ever done?
You know, I don't know. It depends. It depends on a lot of things. I mean, I would have talked to Bobby, and if we decided we want to go at it, yeah, for sure. You know what I mean? We would have got our team together and discussed it, and I'm not sure how that would have turned out, you know?
Yeah.
But I would have really relished a chance to fight Babalu again. You know, when I fought him, I had barely any training at all. I was just a wrestler, and I had trained a little bit at a gym in Idaho, and Babalu was my first fight I went to, AKA in California. And I was down there for 2 weeks. That's the only training I'd had. So,
no. All right. Well, for a guy.
By the time I would have fought him in Strikeforce, I would have been 10 times the fighter I was. And I would really relish that chance to do that, you know?
Well, he was pretty deep in his career, I think, at that point, when you had that first fight. I think he was further along than you were.
Yeah, he'd already fought in the UFC, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. But. But anyways, you would end up fighting several more times in Strikeforce. Overall, since this podcast is about the history of Strikeforce, overall, what are your thoughts on your time in the promotion? Any, you know, kind of lasting memories, or any just overall, this is how I feel about my time in Strikeforce?
No, I enjoyed the Strikeforce days. I really enjoyed working with Scott Coker. I thought he was really fair and personable. You know what I mean? He gave me his cell phone number, and if I needed something, I called him, you know, and it's just, I thought it was a great organization. I enjoyed working with it. I enjoyed fighting with it. I mean, it wasn't anything like the Bodog, but nothing was at that stage. But it was a really fair, good organization, and I enjoyed every fight there. You know what I mean? I wish I had performed a little bit better on some of my fights, you know, and maybe worked my way into a title contention would have been awesome.
You mentioned Bodog fight, which I don't know a ton about the promotion. I remember hearing some whispers back then about some kind of weird stuff, but just kind of what did you mean by what you said there? Was that held in a positive light or in more of a negative light?
Because positive. I honestly believe, as far as fighters were concerned, Bodog was the best, funnest, fairest organization that ever was in MMA.
Really?
That's probably why it didn't last. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. It's if they were that fighter friendly, then maybe business wise, it wasn't going to work out.
Yeah, but it was. I mean, when the run we had with Bodog, if you speak to the guys who were there, was the best. There's nobody who fought for Bodog that has anything bad to say about it, as far as I know, as far as the organization itself. You know.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Like I said, I don't know very much about them. I remember hearing about them, and they had a relationship with Strikeforce. They sponsored some of the early events, and obviously a lot of crossover. And, you know, Jorge Masvidal was under contract with them, fought for Strikeforce, several other guys, so including yourself. So that, you know, that makes sense. You still have your championship belt from Bodog?
Yeah,
you
get a belt for that? I still got it. Yep.
Okay, cool. Might get some money for that someday, some hardcore MMA fan out there or something.
I'll keep it though. Give it to my kid.
There you go. All right. Well, let's before we get to our final question, let's talk about what you're up to today. You run an AKA affiliated gym in Hayden, Idaho, Trevor Prangley's AKA. And I noticed that I checked out your website. Jason Lambert, UFC veteran, is your BJJ instructor, which I was a fan of his because he was my height, and kind of I don't look like him in the face a little bit, but he was like, if I was going to be a fighter, I would have had his body type. So I was always kind of a fan of his. So that was kind of cool to see his name up on the website. But tell us about, I believe the website is tpaka.com. Yeah. Tell us about the gym. Anything else that you've got going on?
Well, we just moved the gym, and we just moved into a 5,500 square foot warehouse and about 3 weeks ago. And we're just keeping going. You know, we're keeping them more of a lower profile because of this, all of that's going on right now with the COVID and stuff. So, you know, we don't need to be poking the bear, but we're going to keep open and keep going as much as long as we can. You know, I do have Jason. He moved up here, I think 2 years ago, and he teaches a noon class jiu-jitsu for me. And, you know, he comes in, trains at night and stuff. And it's been good to have him. It's good for the gym to have two UFC vets in it.
For
and,
sure.
Yeah, I have a lot of good guys, a lot of good instructors. And we focus mainly on jiu-jitsu and public classes as opposed to fighters. I'm not trying to build a fight gym. You know what I mean? I had my day in the fights. I liked it. But as far as promoting and so forth, I don't have the same interest in that as I have in just coaching regular folks, you know?
Okay, makes sense. All right. Well, if you're a listener and you're in the Idaho area, as long as you're not going to bring any unwanted eyeballs, make sure you check out Trevor's gym, of course. But you went 10-2-1 in your last 13 fights, which included winning the King of the Cage light heavyweight title. You defended that belt six times. Looking back now, and I know this might be a little bit tough. I mean, you had, you know, what, 50 professional fights. Is there one fight that really stands out in your mind as being like, this is my signature fight? Like if somebody says, you know, hey, I want to know, I never saw you fight, like, give me one fight to watch. What's the one Trevor Prangley fight?
There was a lot of them, you know, but I think that, yeah. So when I fought Yuki Kondo, I felt like I was at my best ever. I had the best training camp I'd had. I was in the best shape, and really there was concern going into that fight because he's a really tough, wily opponent, but it was one of my best performances, like I said, and it was really an easy fight for me. So I think if Bodog had kept going, I believe I was supposed to fight Gegard Mousasi for the title after Yuki Kondo, but the organization had ended by the time we were supposed to fight. So that would have been a great test. And, you know, Bodog ending kind of took the wind out of my sails a little bit because I felt like we'd hit the pinnacle there. You know, I finally at the top got a title in an organization that's pulling tough fighters in and so forth. And, you know, now it's done. So, and plus I was getting older too. So it was really hard to pick up another legitimate organization, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go back and see if I can find that fight. Cause I would like to see, I know Bodog does have some fights on YouTube, and I don't know if they're on UFC Fight Pass, but I'll definitely try to find
them. Yeah, I don't know. You know what I mean? They're tough to find some of those older fights, but that was a good fight. That was a great organization. I mean, we had Eddie Alvarez fight in there.
Oh yeah. Eve Edwards.
George had a bunch of really tough. Fedor fought for them once. We had Roy Nelson in there. We had a ton of people, you know?
Yeah. The guys run it. Definitely new fighters. Yeah. No question about that. So, all right. Well, Trevor, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the show today. It was great catching up with you and hearing your experiences with Strikeforce and outside the promotion. So thank you for joining
us.
You're
welcome, man. Thanks a lot.
All right. I want to thank my very special guest, Trevor Prangley, for joining us on the show today. Hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did. It was really nice talking with a guy that I've watched fight many times. It was very cool getting his perspective on things. Hope that you've also been enjoying the other episodes that we've been putting out, that you've been enjoying what we're putting out on social media. Again, you can follow us on Instagram and on Twitter at The Hexagon Pod. You can also message us there. You can also message me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to hear from you. Would also love that if you would consider giving us a rating and review, whether it's Apple Podcasts or however you find this show. Would really appreciate that type of support and would appreciate your feedback as well. Looking ahead, we are going to be covering Strikeforce Payback, which featured the only Strikeforce fights of Frank Trigg and Michelle the Karate Hottie Watterson. We're also going to be covering Dwayne Bang Ludwig's main event fight against Sammy Morgan. So it's an interesting event that we've got coming up. After that, I'm not sure exactly who we're going to have on from that show. We're still working on it. We have a yes from Frank Trigg, but we don't have a date yet. So I'm not sure exactly when that's going to run, but we will see. I'm sure we'll get somebody. After that, we're going to be covering Strikeforce Destruction, which was an extremely interesting
Wrestling card, and that featured Babalu Sobral winning the Strikeforce Light Heavyweight title from Bobby Southworth, and Babalu is going to be on the show the week after that, and that is, we've already had that discussion, actually, and that's going to be, it's very interesting. You are going to greatly enjoy that chat. He's very, very open, very honest, and I think you're going to love that. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Sports stars. They're like superheroes.
But they're actually real.
Which is why we've made a podcast about them. You see,
they've all got a story.
But too many of these stories were cut short.
Kobe Bryant.
Payne Stewart.
Flo Jo.
Phil Hughes.
Justin Fashanu.
We're writing episodes about all of them.
And sadly, many more.
Death of a Sports Star. A new series from Crowd Network.